You are currently listening to the High Costing Podcast.
You are now about to witness the strength of street knowledge. What's going down, my people? Firstly, I want to start out by saying thank you for your patience. It's been a couple of months. You might be thinking, where has he been? I've been just doing a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Summer came and went. I had some living to do. I turned 30. I went to Japan for a month. Came back. I had two weddings. My nephew was born. I went to Spain. Working a lot. A lot of nights out. A lot of parties. And mostly I've just been coming to terms with like letting go of my past and embracing my future. People close to me will understand what I mean. Actually, you know, fuck it, I'll just say it out. Me and my wife split up. She dumped me. I'm not going to be one of those guys that says, oh, it was a mutual agreement. No, it wasn't. She dumped me. And I've mainly just been dealing with that, you know. I feel like I've just been on the piss for like the last 3 or 4 months. I'm either at work or I'm somewhere drinking in a pub or at a house party or something. I have not been podcasting at all. I haven't been looking after myself at all. No gym, no nothing. Like, I fell off in a big way during the summer. But I'm slowly crawling out of this long rut that I've been in. And I'm good. Don't worry about me. I'm about to bounce back in a big way, Poppy. And my latest episode was about Cork's House of Horror, you might remember. And that was my best performing episode to date. It was kind of stupid of me not to capitalize on the momentum garnered from that episode. But whatever, life gets in the way sometimes. Japan was absolutely amazing. The trip was kind of my way of just trying to get over the separation, you know. Go out there on my own for a month, have a think about things, map out where I want to go from here, explore a new country, a new culture, in a once-in-a-lifetime trip, you could say, you know. And when I got home from that trip, the plan was just let go and move on. Soon as I step off that airplane in Cork Airport, that's it. Leave that shit in the past. Like I said, just, yeah, let go of the past and embrace the future. I know it sounds a bit corny, but it's true. Like, I'd love to tell you all about Japan, but that's not what this podcast is about anymore. This is strictly true crime, motherfuckers. So no more chit-chat about my personal life. What I will say, though, is packing up and heading to Japan on my own for 3 weeks was one of the best decisions that I have ever made. I was a bit nervous to go out there solo, especially for a month. Like, it's a long time when you're on your own. But I'm so glad I did. Highly, highly recommended to anyone that's flirting with the idea of doing a bit of solo travel. And no better place to do it than Japan. Okay, now that that's out of the way, today I want to take you back to last summer. Summer 22, when I visited California. I did a hood tour, or a day trip, to the ghettos of South Central LA, Compton, Watts, and Crenshaw, and basically all around an area that was once dubbed the murder capital of America. Now, this is a topic I knew I would talk about on the podcast eventually, so I said, alright, why not do it today and ease my way back into putting out more crime stories. Besides, how many people do you know have been to Compton? How many people do you know can say, yeah, I've walked through Compton? Like, probably not many. But I am that guy. It's not top of anyone's bucket list, so I'm here to describe the whole experience to you and just tell you what it was like, and that's what I'm going to do today. I am working on a couple of other tricky episodes that are like very detailed, and they have a lot of in-depth information that I need to do research on. I'm still currently researching and working on those episodes, so I thought, okay, let's do the Compton episode today. In the meantime, fire it out to my lovely listeners, because it's just me basically describing my day in the hood, and it doesn't require too much research. It's just me basically going off the cuff now, talking about my day trip to Bompton. Now, most of you have probably heard about Compton at some point through either music or a gangster movie. So I'm not going to give you a big long history lesson about the area, but I will just quickly go over some of the main things that you probably should know, and then I'll describe my trip over there. Compton is a city in south central Los Angeles, California, United States, obviously. Situated south of downtown LA, Compton has a history of violence and gang wars. It has been rated as one of the most dangerous cities in America in the past. It's a working class or lower class community that is ethnically diverse. It has a total population of 96,000 residents. On the intro to Dr. Dre's latest album, there's a short 1 minute history lesson about the city of Compton itself. So I'm just going to read out the lyrics that I suppose they're not really lyrics. It's just like an old news station news reporter talking about Compton. It sounds old, but Dr. Dre put that in the intro of his album, and I heard that and I thought it summarizes everything very quickly in like 1 minute. So I looked up the lyrics there, and I'm just gonna read that out. Great intro to the album, by the way. Like, there's background music to this, and it's pretty sick. You should check that out. Compton was the American dream. Sunny California with a palm tree in the front yard, the camper and the boat. Temptingly close to the Los Angeles ghetto in the 1950s and 60s, it became the Black American Dream. Open housing paved the way as middle-class blacks flooded into the city. Whites don't buy houses in Compton anymore. Now with 74% of the population, black power is the fact of life. From banks to bowling alleys, but the dream that many blacks thought they were buying has turned sour. Though the mayor and four out of the five city councilmen are black, they have been unable to solve the problems of crime and growing welfare, which is slowly turning suburban Compton into an extension of the black inner city. Crime is now as high as the ghetto. 47 homicides last year gave Compton one of the highest per capita rates in the country. Juvenile gang activity, muggings, small robberies make most blacks want to leave. And then the beat kicks in and it just goes crazy. So that's it, summed up. Two key words that stand out to me at the end of that are gang activity. Compton is the birthplace of Bloods and Crips and many other gangs, including Latin gangs, as there is also a high population of Mexicans and Latin Americans in South Central LA. The Bloods gang was formed initially to compete against the influence of the Crips in Los Angeles. The rivalry between the Bloods and the Crips originated in the late 1960s when a man named Raymond Washington and other Crips attacked Sylvester Scott and Benson Owens. Two students at two students at the Centennial High School in Compton, California. The Bloods was initially formed to provide members protection from the Crips. Many of the non-Crip gangs used to call one another Blood. That's how they just named themselves the Bloods, I suppose. And then you have different subgroups within the larger group, or sets as they're known as. For example, you have Piru Bloods, or you could have Rolling 60s Crips. They're like subgroups of the main group, you know. It mainly started as gangs just retaliating against each other. They kill my friend, now we'll kill them. Then their cousin kills us, so my uncle kills them. That type of thing, you know. And eventually it just exploded to the point where nearly everyone in the world knows about the Bloods and the Crips. In 1978, there were 15 Blood sets. Crips still outnumbered Bloods 3-1. But to assert their power, the Bloods became increasingly violent. And during the 1980s, Bloods began distributing crack cocaine in Los Angeles. Blood membership soon rose dramatically, as did the number of states in which they were present. These increases were primarily driven by profits from cocaine distribution. The huge profits allowed the gang members to relocate to other cities and other states across America. These gangs are very well organized. They have, in some cases, their own languages that they use. They have gang symbols or gang signs. They have leaders, bosses, middlemen, and lower level bosses. If you want to join the gang, you have to get jumped in, where they'll kick the shit out of you first, and after you take your beating like a man, you're in. They recruit young, naive men and women, usually from single parent housing, which is most of them. Teenagers are attracted to the gang culture. Usually they drop out of school and join the gang as a way to protect themselves and give themselves some sense of belonging. They usually can't get jobs and they rely on selling drugs to support themselves. And statistically, most gang members will eventually end up dead or in jail. And I feel sorry for them, like, really, as you know, it's not their fault. They're born into this environment and your chances of escaping it are very low. But anyway, that's just a bit about the background information. Now, why don't we get into my day trip to Compton and its surrounding neighborhoods, Watts and Crenshaw. So I was in LA waiting for my ex-wife to arrive. I purposefully flew out to Los Angeles a few days early because I knew there was things there that I wanted to see and do that she would have no interest in. One of them being a trip to the ghetto. She thought I was foolish for going down there. It might be dangerous. I'm putting myself in a vulnerable situation. And you know what? She was probably right. But I went anyway. There's this website called Hood Tours. A fella at work actually showed it to me about a week before I went out there. And he was like, you have to go do this. I was like, I'm definitely doing that. There are so many tours around Hollywood that take you around, you know, on a bus to see like famous actors' houses and film locations and whatnot. We did that tour as well, but that was really just for the girls, you know. There's Gwen Stefani's house. Brilliant. Great. But this is a tour that takes you right into the heart of the ghetto, the jungle, the trenches. Big Mike is the tour guide. He's an OG Compton Crip and former bodyguard at Dr. Dre and Suge Knight's record label, Death Row Records. So he says. He's 65 years old and he spent 25 years behind bars. When he got out, obviously he found it difficult to find work, so he just bought a minibus and started doing hood tours, aimed at guys like me that want to go see the ghetto in real life. So of course I booked it. I showed up at the meeting spot and there were two other black elderly couples. They were coming on the tour as well. I think they said they were from Philadelphia, probably in their 60s as well, like, and they sat in the back of the minibus and they literally didn't say a word for the whole day. They were just like observing, pure like NPCs. They were literally like on mute for the entire time we were there, which was like 4 hours. It was like they weren't even there. They weren't even talking to each other. They just sat there happy out, soaking up the scenery. But Big Mike drove the van around and I was riding shotgun, asking all the questions. It was like a podcast in the minibus for 3-4 hours, just between me and him. I swear to God, I felt like Ross Kemp sitting next to him, driving around and quizzing this guy and learning all about the history and sussing him out to see if he was a spoof or not. He would have been a serious guest for the podcast, but I didn't bother asking him, and obviously it would have been fairly hard to organise, so I just left it off. Thankfully, I recorded a lot of what he was talking about and I compiled it all into a reel and just posted it on my podcast Instagram page, if you want to go check it out there, at thc.pod. Give the page a follow while you're there. He was a big guy, definitely lived up to his name, Big Mike. Definitely could have played football or something when he was younger. And he looked like he could definitely be somebody's bodyguard. I immediately noticed that he was missing a finger. He showed me his gunshot wounds and he told me that he had recently lost his brother to gang violence just a few years before. So I reckon he was legit, like, and any man that's been in jail for 25 years, you know what that means. Like, he definitely caught a body when he was younger. But he wouldn't tell me the details around it. All he said was that he witnessed a murder and he got arrested because he was kind of associated with the murder, but he didn't actually commit the murder and he didn't snitch on his friend. He knew who pulled the trigger, but he wouldn't tell the cops who did it. So they basically just kind of, he may as well have pulled it himself. He got 25 years in jail. Anyway, he assured me that the minibus we were in was bulletproof because the areas that he'd be taking us are neighbourhoods where the bullets could just start flying at any given time of the day. Gang banging. It's like when rival gangs have shootouts and Shane O'Mac from the back ass of Glentown rolls through with Big Mike. You could literally be in the wrong place at the wrong time. He explained, though, that a lot of that he has a lot of street credit as an OG. Like, people know him and respect his business, so if you're with Big Mike, you're safe. You have what's called a hood pass. So I think I got one of those for the day. But then again, I'm literally just taking this guy's word for it. Like, he could be completely full of shit. I don't think he was, though. But at the time, he could have been, for all I knew. But in hindsight, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt, you know. Anyway, our first stop was a place called Baldwin Hills. This is an area where a lot of wealthy black people live, like rappers, NFL players, entrepreneurs, probably basketball players. Big Mike explained that in the 1980s they didn't want black people living in Beverly Hills, so most rich and successful black people settled in Baldwin Hills. So most of them remain there to this day. Absolute beautiful houses now, mansions, like. Perfect weather, perfect views from up there as well. It's unreal. Now obviously times have changed. If you have money, you can buy a house wherever you want, regardless of your skin colour. I think Magic Johnson lives around Baldwin Hills. It's actually a beautiful neighbourhood. Like I said, fantastic views of LA, and it's safe enough too, despite being next door to the ghetto. It's actually fascinating how he explained that you have the ghetto on one side of the street, the hood, like proper, the jungle, and literally just across the road, you're in a wealthy area. And the guys in the ghetto tend to leave Baldwin Hills alone, for whatever reason. They don't enter the neighborhood, so crime is kept relatively low and it's safe in Baldwin Hills. But I mean, it's literally like walking from, if you're familiar with Cork, you're a Cork listener, it's like walking from Merchants Quay over to McCurtain Street. They're that close, like. And one is a wealthy area and one is the absolute trenches. So after that, we came out of Baldwin Hills and we start heading towards the hood. We stopped at a red light outside the church. And Big Mike is saying to me, "This church you see on the right here, a lot of your favorite rappers go to church here every Sunday." He said, "Magic Johnson comes here every Sunday. Kobe used to come here. Nipsey Hussle's funeral was in here." So that was cool to see. Like, we actually spent a lot of time talking about Nipsey Hussle's murder back in 2019. We went to the spot where he was shot and killed, which was outside his own clothing store in Crenshaw Boulevard. So we went inside for a look. I'm actually planning to do a full episode dedicated to Nipsey Hussle sometime in the future, so I'm not going to talk about it too much right now. And next up, we started heading towards the house from Friday, where you might remember Ice Cube and Chris Tucker are just chilling on the porch, smoking doobies all day. That was cool to see. You've Miss Parker's house across the road. Miss Parker. We also visited Ice Cube's house from Boys in the Hood, which was very close by. Handy gig for him, like, you know, Ice Cube just doing all the movies in basically the same street. We were kind of close by the side street where Ricky gets shot. You might remember if you've seen the film. Possibly the saddest scene in film history. And we're just going around that area for a while. He had a couple of places he wanted to show me. He said, "I don't usually drive by these places," but he knew I was an NWA fan, and he's like, "I'll do it for you. I'll do it just for you, Shane O'Mac." And I'm like, "Top man, top G, Big Mike. Let's go." So we drove by Eazy-E's old house, and we drove outside the club where NWA was essentially formed. We were basically talking about hip-hop history, and I do know my stuff, which I could tell he appreciated. But if you don't know the history behind NWA, you should watch the movie, even though there are a lot of inaccuracies in that too. But Dr. Dre, who I've mentioned quite a few times in this podcast, he started DJing with his group, the World Class Wrecking Crew. The club was ran by a guy named Lonzo, who hated gangster rap. This place was all dance and techno music. Eazy-E, who was actually, he was the only real gangster out of NWA. He was proper, like, from the street. He knew Dr. Dre. Like, he used to go to the club where Dr. Dre DJed. He would go in there at the weekend. Dr. Dre and Ice Cube were friends. Dr. Dre was like the producer who made the beats that were way ahead of their time back in the 80s. And Ice Cube was the lyricist who could write raps that nobody else was doing at that level back in the mid 80s. And like I said, Eazy-E was the man with the money, the hustler. He had accumulated so much money at such a young age from selling drugs. It's believed that he actually bought like a 6-4 Impala. Do you know, the cruising down the street in my 6-4. He bought that when he was 13 years old and it cost him $100K or something like that. Like, that's insane for a 13 year old. He must have been selling a lot of dope. But Eazy-E had money. Everyone knew that. So Dr. Dre and Ice Cube came to Eazy-E and basically asked him, "Would you be willing to invest in a record label or a music group?" So they created Ruthless Records and they formed the group NWA, and the rest is history. Go watch the film, because there's a lot of places in that film where me and Big Mike were basically hanging out. Even the chances of me becoming a fan of NWA were so slim, by the way. Like, the group had broken up before I was even born. But when I was like 10 years old, I went back and discovered them. Music that no 10-year-old in the world should be listening to, by the way, but such is life. But as a lifelong fan of the group, it was a great experience to go to the spot where the group would hang out, where they would drink, essentially where the group was formed, and like I said, where history was made. So what else did we do on that day? We talked a lot about Kobe as well. We're driving down a street and he said Kobe and his wife would come out here and they'd park up over this side of the street every Sunday and they'd give out free turkeys to everybody. He loved Kobe and the hood loved Kobe too. A lot of murals around of Kobe and Nipsey as well. Two hood legends that died in the space of a few months. And obviously died way before their time as well. So I'm just going to quickly list a few well-known famous places that we drove by. The fast food burger place where there's a shootout in the final scene of Boys in the Hood. You know, and Ice Cube is at the end of Boys in the Hood when Ice Cube is trying to get revenge for the boys killing his brother. He pulls up and he sees the lads eating a burger outside some fast food place. And he's like, there they go right there. And he basically gets out and shoots them. I was at that burger place. I didn't get anything, but it's cool to be there and just be like, what the fuck? That movie is like 30 years old as well and it's still there. It looks the exact same from the film as well. That was a cool experience. But we went to Watts Tower, which is pretty sick. There's a lot of history behind that as well. A guy just started making Watts Tower out of rubbish. And he was like 70. And he made a fucking massive tower out of bottle caps and basically litter. And it's huge. For a guy, there's pictures of him outside as well. Like a 70-year-old man. Like way up on a fucking roof. No harness or nothing. Like one misstep and he's dead. But he made Watts Tower himself. That's pretty. It's worth looking up, actually. Cool to be there, though, and see it in real life. There's a park that you'd recognize instantly if you watch, like, music videos. And obviously, I grew up watching a lot of music videos on those channels back in the day. He said, like, you remember the Still Dre music video? He had all the fancy lowriders lined up on this street here. And I was like, man, that's sick. That's like one of the best music videos ever. And he was saying how back in the day they used to have the best cars you'd ever see just parked up. What else, bro? Kendrick Lamar's childhood home. The Game's childhood home. One of Death Row Records' old recording studios. One of my favorite films, actually, Training Day with Denzel Washington. The film is based in Compton. And Big Mike was like, remember when Denzel walks into the house with a fake warrant? He has a Chinese restaurant menu in his hand and he's pretending that it's a search warrant and he walks into the house and just waves the Chinese menu and pretends it's a search warrant. And Khalees, you know, the R&B singer, she's playing the role of a crackhead in the house. And then there's a big shootout on the street right outside the house. And Big Mike just points over to a house and he's like, there goes the house right there where they film that scene. And I'm like, holy shit, it actually is. I thought that was cool to see. In that film as well, they go to a street in Compton known as the Jungles. We drove down there and it was actually pretty scary. This was probably the scary part of the trip, you know. Everything else seemed fine. But everywhere we went, I was like an annoying tourist at a safari taking pictures of the lions out the window. You know me, I get a lot of pictures and footage and whatnot. But when we drove down through the jungles and the Section 80 project buildings, Big Mike was saying, put your phone down going through here. You don't want to be caught taking a picture of a gang member or someone's house or, you know, whatever, they will literally kill you for the smallest of things. So I put the phone down for this part of the trip. Kendrick Lamar even named his first album after this area, Section 80. This is the real, real ghetto, you know. You could even feel it in the air as soon as we drove in there. It's like something changed the atmosphere. It felt dangerous. It's a dark place, and I already knew the whole history about this area based on the music I listened to, like I say, Kendrick, his first album. I remember seeing a few Latin gangsters or vatos sitting outside their house, kind of on the footpath, all of them drinking 40s, white tank tops, big mustaches, basketball shorts with the socks pulled up to the knee, tatted from head to toe, and they were all strapped as well. They had like not just guns but assault rifles literally on full display, not even attempting to hide them like your stereotypical Mexican gangbanger. And we were stopped at a red light about 2 feet away from these boys, and of course they were on my side of the van, and we were parked there for well over a minute, and I just remember making eye contact with one of them. And he was staring me down like he had no problem opening fire. And I was genuinely afraid. The guy was just looking into my soul. And then I just threw up a gang sign and we drove off. Nah, I'm joking, obviously. In those kind of situations, you can't fuck around, really. But it's just mad to think that one gang sign or one hand gesture out the window would more than likely get you killed out there. They take that stuff very, very seriously. So, yeah, like I said, you don't fuck about in that situation. We talked a good bit about Tupac and Tupac's murder. Then Big Mike said, "I used to tell Tupac all the time not to get caught up with Suge and all his gangbangers." And I'm like, "Wait, wait, wait, what?" I was like, "You knew Tupac?" And he said, "Hell yeah." He was a security guard for Death Row Records. And this is when I started thinking, nah, stop the cap. But he said he knew Tupac and he knew Suge Knight in the 90s. And he even knew the guys that were responsible for Tupac's murder, Orlando Anderson and his uncle Keefe D. Who, Keefe D has recently been arrested for the murder 27 years after the fact. He knew he killed Tupac. Fuck, even I knew who killed Tupac for years. Like, people have been acting like it's an unsolved mystery, but the information has been out there. I only know because I'm a hip-hop nerd that's watched every documentary available over the years. I remember before YouTube even became what it is now, I was on YouTube watching, I must have been 14 years old watching these documentaries at 2 o'clock in the morning, playing detective, like, but it's always been pinned on this guy Keefe D. It's believed that this guy Keefe D provided his nephew Orlando Anderson with the gun that killed Tupac, and Keefe D was in the car when his nephew pulled the trigger as well in a drive-by shooting. And again, I'm not going to go too into that right now. This is a subject that deserves its own podcast episode as well. So I'll definitely do that sometime in the future. But the murder of one of the biggest rappers in history solved after 27 years, it's pretty mind-blowing stuff, really. And it was cool that I got to talk to Big Mike, someone who knew Tupac, and you know, he knew the guys that killed him as well. Or so he says. And he knew Nipsey. I know he wasn't lying about that because he showed me pictures of him and Nipsey in Nipsey's shop. He used to bring tourists to Nipsey's shop all the time when Nipsey was alive. And when we went into Nipsey's clothes shop, everyone knew Big Mike, like he was a part of the family. So I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. Like, if he says he knew them, I believe him. So that's two new crime, hip hop crime podcast to look forward to. Nipsey Hussle's murder and Tupac's murder. Who knows how long it's going to take me to do them, but if I say I'll do them, trust me, I will. They will come out at some point in the future. And not only that, like, I plan to do Pop Smoke, Takeoff, XXXTentacion, and many more. A lot of murder cases that have happened in hip-hop in recent years. I plan to cover them all at some point, so there's a lot to look forward to there. And, you know, I really just try to continue to build up a catalogue of crime stories. That's my plan for the future. The last thing I'll talk about today is Roscoe's Chicken Shack and the murder of PNB Rock. This is just a quick story about the hood that I visited, and I suppose it touches on the dangers of social media too. I don't have too many details, like, I'm just giving you the full story here off the cuff. I don't have any, you know, research done or anything. This is just what I read a while back. Last year, I think it was. So, if you don't know who PNB Rock is, he's a rapper / R&B singer of this generation. I suppose he's pretty big in America. I'm not sure how many people would know him globally. I personally never listened to his music, but he was featured on one of Pop Smoke's songs, which I do listen to. And I remember thinking after Pop Smoke died, isn't that cool for this guy, PNB Rock? He has a hit song with Pop Smoke, and then Pop Smoke dies, and it's just a cool thing for him to have. And you fast forward to now, and both of them have been murdered. Anyway, he's a guy that, he looks like a rapper, you know. Big chain, diamond watch, probably a nice car. And he decided one day to stop off at Roscoe's Chicken for a bite to eat with his missus. And I think maybe a couple of his other family members were there too. Now, Roscoe's Chicken is a chain all over Los Angeles. There are lyrics in many, many songs over the years that I listened to. There are bars about Roscoe's Chicken in so many hip-hop songs, talking about how dangerous it is. This is where gangbangers go for their chicken. This is where a group of Crips might bump into a group of Bloods, and a shootout is likely to occur. It's notorious for having violent incidents, basically. So at this particular Roscoe's, it's really not too far from LAX airport. And the most heartbreaking fact about this case is that PNB was on his way to the airport to leave Los Angeles and fly back to his home in Philadelphia. He wasn't even from Los Angeles, like, but he didn't make it to the airport that day. It was September 12th, 2022. Really not too long after I got back from LA. But we'll say PNB Rock. He's on his way to LAX to fly home. Him and his girlfriend, they stopped off at Roscoe's and decided to eat their food inside there. They should have got takeaway. His girlfriend took a picture of the food. She tagged PNB Rock and she posted it on her Instagram story. And within a few short minutes, an armed 17-year-old showed up at Roscoe's to rob PNB Rock's jewelry. What's worse is apparently he had gotten all of the jewelry, but still decided to execute the singer right in front of his girlfriend. He was shot several times in the chest and he died on his way to hospital. I remember when that happened, there were videos of him laid out on the ground, bleeding out, body twitching. A tough watch. And the very next day, the shooter and the shooter's father were both arrested in connection with the murder. And, like, I don't know who's videoing something like that. That's shameful. But what a waste of life. A waste of talent, you know. Not just him, but the shooter was so young. Sorry, one sec. There we go. Yeah, the shooter was so young. And, like, he'll likely spend the rest of his life in jail. And for what? Ironically, he was killed. P&B Rock was killed in the very same way Pop Smoke was killed 2 years earlier. And these are the guys that I was saying collaborated on a hit song a while ago. Both in LA. Neither of them are from LA. They're both rappers just visiting LA. And they both died in an armed robbery for some jewelry. I bet his girlfriend feels very guilty for posting that on her story, but I mean, how is she to know things would escalate just like that? But when you're famous, you really have a target on your back, like, especially rappers in America, especially in a place like LA. There's literally groups of gangsters in LA who just browse through social media all day, every day, looking for rich celebrities to rob. It's very well organized. It's like a 9-to-5 for them. If they can find your location, your live location, and if you don't have security, you're fucked, basically. That's why being a regular citizen is probably better than fame or fortune. I mean, nobody's trying to rob and kill me if I go into Roscoe's. They might get an old iPhone and $12.50. Hardly worth it. But these types of murders have been happening more and more to high-profile celebrities and lesser-known people over the last number of years. And you can guarantee that it's going to continue to happen. But anyway, that's going to do it for today's episode. I just wanted to tell people, like, yeah, I went to Compton and made it out. I made it out of the ghetto. So do whatever you want with that information. But thanks for listening. Hopefully you learned something as well. Or hopefully you just enjoyed my company for the last half an hour or so. I'm getting back to it. No more days off. Don't worry about me. I'm good. I'm healthy. I'm getting healthier. I'm in a good space right now. I'll be aiming to put out as much content as possible between now and Christmas. And I'll be hoping to start the new year strong and keep on building this crime podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please do feel free to share a link to the episode on your Instagram story. Or just share it with your friends, throw it into the group chat. Let's get more ears over here. Also, if you have any suggestions, if there's any crime cases that you're interested in and you'd like to hear me talk about, send them on, send a DM. I'd love your input. That'd be great to get you involved. And yeah, we'll just keep building. Alright, that's it for me. I'm gone now. Be good, behave. Deuces!